I'm David Martin Davies, and coming up on The Source, Texas House Democrats have left Texas and are preventing the passage of a sudden mid-decade redistricting map that gives five new seats to Republicans. We're going to have the latest. Also on The Source, as the global population ages, Parkinson's disease is steadily climbing. Parkinson's is a progressive neurological disorder that affects movement, often starting with subtle tremors and stiffness. While Parkinson's cannot yet be cured, cutting-edge treatments are transforming care. One of the most promising is a deep brain stimulation, which is being developed here in San Antonio. The rise of Parkinson's highlights a pressing public health challenge. There is a need for early recognition, investment in research, and support for caregivers. How has Parkinson's impacted you or your family? Call in at 833-877-8255. That's what's coming up on The Source, but first, this news.
Support for The Source podcast comes from UT Health San Antonio, South Texas' largest academic research institution, where what is discovered in its labs translates into life-changing patient care. More at groundbreakingresearch.org.
Independent journalism needs protection, now more than ever. Leaving a gift to TPR in your will helps ensure thoughtful, fact-based news has a future in Texas. Learn more at tpr.org/legacy.
From the John L. Santico Studio in downtown San Antonio, this is The Source from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. The special legislative session in Austin is now in full stop right now, including the drive to pass a new congressional map of Texas that would give Republicans five new seats in Congress. Texas Democratic House members have left the state and have broken quorum to block that map. I'm now joined by San Antonio State Representative Trey Martinez-Fisher to get the latest. So, Representative Martinez-Fisher, what is the mood now that you are in the quorum break?
Well, you know, David, everybody's, you know, very stoic and serious. I mean, this is, you know, it may sound like a local issue that impacts Texas and maybe San Antonio when it comes to congressional districts, but this is a national issue that now has, you know, the country, you know, talking about this topic in states from California to New York, Illinois to Texas. You know, the notion that people would re-redistrict and otherwise cheat because they're worried about an election of 2026. Nobody thought they would see this. This is what our democracy has become. And folks are very, very, you know, serious about finding a way to stop this.
So to boil it down, if those five seats are able to be given to the Republicans by, you know, really drawing some extreme congressional districts in Texas, and that means that Congress is going to be Republican after midterms, which, you know, typically after, you know, a midterm election, the party in power and the White House, they lose seats. So that would mean that there would basically be, as today, no accountability for Trump in Congress. Is that what's at stake?
Yes, and I'm sorry I didn't get that clear in the first question. I mean, for people who are not following this, that is exactly the issue. There is a three-seat Republican majority in the U.S. House of Representatives on elections, on maps that were drawn fair and square, maps that we have used in the last election. You know, Donald Trump is worried about losing that majority, told the governor in Texas, "Will you bend the knee and draw me five brand-new Republican seats? I don't care how, but get me more seats, because I'm worried that we might actually have checks and balances in our government. We might have accountability. We might have a chamber of government that says, no, Donald Trump, you cannot violate people's civil rights and their liberties. You're going to have to answer these questions. Yes, Donald Trump, we are going to have to talk about Donald Epstein. We're going to have to do these things. And that's what he's afraid of. So in the biggest and freest democracy in the world, nobody ever thought this would happen. But now we have a governor who would, you know, forsake our state and forget about the fact that I don't even think Republican members of Congress are okay with them. If you ask them, I don't think they're on board, because the only way you get more Republicans in Texas is to take them from their districts, and now they have become competitive races. And so all of this because our governor will not tell President Trump, you need to go elsewhere, or you need to win these elections fair and square. We're not going to let politicians pick voters. We're going to let voters pick politicians.
Governor Abbott is saying that he wants you arrested along with other Democrats, Trey Martinez Fisher, arrest him and bring him back to Texas, or he's going to remove you from office. I mean, can he do those things?
I think the governor is certainly, you know, shooting first and aiming later. I this is the reaction that we would expect from a governor who recognizes that he has absolutely zero control over what Texas Democrats are doing in Illinois. I think Governor Abbott is very jealous and upset that Governor J.B. Pritzker has offered us a place to stay here in his state under his protection of his state police and is coordinating with us on a daily basis to make sure we're secure. And frankly, I don't think that the governor's talking points are going to supersede the will of the voters who sent me to Austin to do their job. The only way I think I should be removed from office is when the folks who sent me there told me it's time for somebody else, not because Governor Abbott disagrees with me politically.
But can he do that? Does the governor have the ability to remove state representatives from office because they broke quorum?
Yeah, the answer is no. There are provisions in the Constitution that deal with when you abandon your post, when you just walk away and you never show up. We've told the House exactly where we are. We told them why we were leaving, and we told them what the problem is. We have not abandoned our seats. We have used the rules that are in the Constitution to say that when you don't like what's going on and you don't have the numbers, you can't do business. And so I think there's a Constitution that's in conflict. Our ability to use a quorum as a rule and a tactic versus the constitutional provision that the governor is desperately trying to use to say that it applies in these circumstances, which, look, let's be honest, this isn't the first quorum break. This is my fifth quorum break, but yet this is the first time the governor's made that threat. And so I think he's really grasping at straws.
So the reason we have a quorum rule is just because of things like this, is to prevent the tyranny of the majority. Is that it?
That is it. And in Texas, we have a couple of extra provisions in our Constitution. We have a provision that says that we will never be prohibited from our ability to speak and debate. So nobody can shut us up. And number two, nobody can detain us when we are performing legislative duties. Now, so there's some conflict in our Texas Constitution, but you're speaking the exact truth. If our ideas and our policy is so fantastic in Austin, Texas, you shouldn't have any problem getting 100 members to show up and go to work. It's only when the majority wants to run roughshod over the rights of the minority, and in this case, trample the Constitution and our congressional districts in the process, then 51 members can say not on our watch. And that's what we said last night when we left.
Well, how long can you keep this up? I mean, you go through a 30-day session and he calls another session. He can call as many special sessions as he likes.
He can do that till the cows come home, but he recognizes what we know. By a date certain, we have to have people who are running for office in districts that they know. And Secretary of State and local elections officials have to start letting people know who they can vote for, where their districts are. And so time is actually on our side, not on their side. That's why you have these desperate measures. And then on top of that, look, let's face it, I've done quorum breaks that have lasted a couple of hours, and I did one that lasted for 6 weeks in 2021. The idea is, America, we have a problem. You know, we need to wake up and we need to rise up. And I'm glad that we have a delegation of lawmakers in New York State, in Albany right now, meeting with Governor Hochul, talking about, well, if Trump is going to cheat in Texas, well, what's good for the goose is good for the gander. We know that Governor Newsom is taking legislative proposals to his chamber. And I also know states like Maryland, New Jersey, and other places are saying, okay, if it's going to be a race to the bottom, if Donald Trump wants to lead a race to the bottom, we will meet him halfway. And so, let's see what happens. Maybe the courts will step in and say, everybody, you need to stop your business. We have districts, and let's run in 2026. But Texas Democrats, if we have to be the spark that wakes this country up so that we can let folks know that our democracy is being stolen right before our eyes, then that is the job we're going to do. It's not the job we asked for, but it's the job we're going to do.
That is San Antonio State Representative Trey Martinez Fisher, former leader of the State House Democratic Caucus and a leader in the quorum-breaking maneuver by House Democrats This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. We'll be back in 1 minute. Stay with us.
Support for this podcast of The Source comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company. They are committed to helping policyholders build strong and thriving businesses through their exceptional service. More at texasmutual.com/texansdeliver. Texas Mutual. Texans get it.
Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Parkinson's disease is a progressive neurological disorder that affects nearly 1 million people in the United States, with 90,000 new cases diagnosed each year. It begins quietly, sometimes with a subtle tremor, a softening of the voice, or the loss of smell, and gradually takes on a profound toll of movement, independent quality of life, and then eventually death. Beyond the personal impact, Parkinson's carries a staggering economic cost, an estimated more than $50 billion a year in medical expenses and lost productivity. Despite decades of research, there is still no cure, but there is hope. Breakthroughs in deep brain stimulation, gene therapy, and stem cell research are giving scientists new tools to slow the disease and improve lives. Today, we're joined by Okeanis Bowell, Professor of Neurology and Division Chief for the Movement Disorder Program at UT Health San Antonio, to talk about Parkinson's disease. And Dr. Bao, welcome to The Source.
Thank you so much. It's such a pleasure for me to be here and talk about Parkinson's and raise awareness about this very pronounced disease.
Yeah, that's what I really wanted to do. I do want to raise awareness, because I think early detection, I mean, is early detection critical in helping people, you know, fight Parkinson's?
Well, that's a good question. It is very important to know the first symptoms of Parkinson's disease, mostly because although there's no cure, there are things that one can do to perhaps slow down the disease or improve the quality of life. For example, exercise is one of them, healthy living, quality of life, and healthy diet is one of the suggested ways of improving and perhaps delaying the progression of the disease.
So what are those early symptoms? What can people monitor? Because a lot of people will think that a slight hand tremor is this part of aging, but is that necessarily so?
It is something I do see it in clinic. I see quite a few patients. And what's very common is that they've had the disease for at least 2 to 3 or even 4 years and without the diagnosis. Either their doctors were telling them, dismissing the tremor, saying that, oh, it's aging, like you just said. Or it might be essential tremor, given the diagnosis of essential tremor, which is the benign tremor, which you may have heard, or familial tremor, it's the same diagnosis. It's very important to note that when little subtle things, right, like you mentioned, the decrease in sense of smell, not necessarily that means you have Parkinson's, but it's one of those little subtle signs that you might want to think about, hey, maybe I should check it out. The slight tremor, it needs to be more of a resting tremor, like when someone's sitting on their couch watching TV in the evening and their spouse notices that their hand is shaking a little bit, especially one side, not both. A lot of my patients show me, hey, look at my tremors, and they lift up their arms trying to demonstrate what their tremors look like. That's not so much the Parkinson's disease. That's more of a familial tremor, or essential tremor, as we call it. So it really, the character of the tremor is different in Parkinson's. It's more of a resting tremor when people are resting their arms on their lap or they're distracted. That's when the tremor comes along. And other things such as slow movements. If you're no longer keeping up with everyone else when you're walking, maybe you should consider Parkinson's as the cause. Other things is what we call the autonomic dysfunction, such as constipation or drop of your blood pressure when you stand up very fast. Things like that are the first signs. But most importantly, if people act out their dreams at night, so talk in their sleep, yell, scream, punch their bed partner by accident, live their dreams when they're dreaming in their sleep, that is a big red flag that some neurodegenerative disorder is brewing, such as Parkinson and related disorders, and you should seek the expertise of a neurologist and more specifically someone who deals with patients with Parkinson's or Parkinsonism, to give you direction as what that might be.
Our phone lines are open. If you have a question or comment, you want to talk about how Parkinson's has impacted you and your family, give us a call. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. Dr. Bao, there seems to be a lot of myths and misunderstandings about Parkinson's in the general population. Some people think that Muhammad Ali has Parkinson's, and people assume that he has it because, he was a fighter and he got hit in the head a lot, or things like that. Or maybe, Ozzy Osbourne, he had Parkinson's. I think, oh, he abused alcohol and other drugs. That might have been the cause of his Parkinson's. But what do we know about the reality? What to strip away the myths.
Yeah, well, there are myths for sure. But I wouldn't take away the genetic causes or the causes of Parkinson's from multiple head traumas that one might have from boxing or exposure to chemicals. People who were exposed to Agent Orange, for example, who fought in Vietnam, have a higher risk of developing Parkinson's. So the environment and the toxins certainly play a role. We know that pesticides have a large impact and do cause Parkinson's. So there, we don't know exactly what causes Parkinson's, but we do know what pushes someone to who may have the predisposition to have and develop the disease. We know that about 15% of the patients who have Parkinson's have some type of a genetic mutation. Here at UT Health, we are testing almost all patients that want to get tested. We're testing them for genetic causes of their Parkinson's disease. So it's not just one size fits all. There are multiple reasons that one might have or develop Parkinson's, and there's many times that we don't know. It doesn't run in the family. The patient didn't have any trauma or head trauma injuries and never got exposed to chemicals.
Let's go to a caller. Our number is 833-877-8255. We want to hear from the community about their impact on Parkinson's. Let's go to Carol. And Carol, hi, you're on the air.
Okay, thank you for taking my question. I have a question about my husband, who he's early 70s now, but since our 40s, he has acted out in our sleep. He doesn't have a tremor, but at night he does talk, he does move. Goes into REM immediately. And I wonder, is this a neurodegenerative disorder? And everything else cognitively is fine, but it's that nighttime sleeping of just movements and talking that has me worried. Should we have something like that tested?
All right, Carol, thank you for that. So it seems like she says, does he has those symptoms. You mentioned them earlier. That doesn't necessarily mean he has Parkinson's, I guess, but they do need to be checked that out. Is there a way to test, he should be tested? Dr. Bao?
Thank you, Carol, for calling in for your question. That is a very good question. So we do know that people who have these type of activity at night in their dreams have a higher predisposition and develop some type of Parkinsonian or degeneration, neurodegeneration 10, 15, 20, even 30 years later. The majority, it is due to a neurodegenerative disorder. However, people who have other conditions such as obstructive sleep apnea or narcolepsy, some other sleep disorders, might also have these symptoms. So if your husband or if for the audience, anyone who has these active dreams and they have nothing else, it might be good to get an opinion from a movement disorder specialist whether there's a test or not. There are some suggestive tests such as a skin biopsy or an imaging called the DAT scan that might be able to give us some clues as to whether the patient has the disease. And sometimes if seen by a very observant observant eye of a specialist who sees movement disorders patients and Parkinson patients, they might even be able to detect subtle changes in the movement that might point towards a direction of Parkinson's or other neurodegenerative disorders such as Lewy body dementia and multiple systems atrophy. These are some of the other neurodegenerative disorders that start with active dreams.
Let's go to Gerald on the phones. And Gerald, you're on the air.
Thank you. Dr. Val is my movement disorder specialist. And she got me probably a couple years into my Parkinson's journey. And we went through DBS surgery last November. And that really changed things for the positive for me. Still have a few little issues working through now. But the DBS surgery was a game changer.
Gerald, thank you for the call. I appreciate you and good luck to you. EBS, that's the electronic brain stimulation. You're doing stimulation of a specific part of the brain to help people treat Parkinson's, Dr. Bao?
Yes. So, and thank you for the comment. I really appreciate it. And it's deep brain stimulation. That's what DBS stands for. It's not a new therapy. It was first FDA approved in 2002 for Parkinson's. What it is, it's similar to the pacemaker for the heart, only it's for the brain. So it stimulates the brain continuously, offering a different type of therapy, different than the oral medications or the medications overall. So we don't stop medications. It doesn't slow down the disease. But it adds to the therapy with less of the side effects that medications have, and it's adjustable, so we can always adjust the therapy, the stimulation. We can increase it or decrease it, adjust the parameters as the disease progresses and other symptoms that might come up.
So, I mean, Parkinson's has something to do with dopamine, detection of the brain. And this helps with that?
So Parkinson's disease is a dysfunction of this. There's certain neurons, there's certain nerve cells that produce dopamine very deep inside the brain. And now dopamine is responsible for many things, but one of the things that it is primarily responsible is for movement. So our coordination, how we, you know, our movements are so smooth. Dopamine is responsible for that. So decrease of dopamine, because those cells are, for lack of a better word, dying slowly. So the dopamine production decreases with time in Parkinson's. That's why we see the tremor starting. We see the slower movements, lack of coordination, balance, etc. So to go back to your question, deep brain stimulation does not make those cells produce more dopamine. It just stimulates that area and overrides the system that is no longer functioning so well, the whole circuitry in the brain, because our brain is basically neurons connected to each other and that's what deep brain stimulation does. It really replaces that circuitry that's not
well. Amplifies the effects.
Yeah, it's amplifying, or it really replaces what is broken. What it's not fixing it, but basically redirecting those connections and improving them.
We're going to take a break here. We're going to continue our conversation about Parkinson's disease. What is it? What could be causing it? How to treat it? What are the impacts of it on our society? Why we need to be aware of Parkinson's disease? Look at early detection, and how are we going to help the caregivers as well? You can give us a call. Tell us about how Parkinson's is intersecting with your life. 833-877-8255. 8255, 833-TPR-TALK, and The Source continues after this break. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies, having a conversation with Dr. Okeanis Bao. She is a professor of neurology and division chief of the Movement Disorders Program at UT Health San Antonio, talking about Parkinson's disease, early detection and treatment, and the future of trying to beat Parkinson's disease, what kind of research needs to be going on, needs to be funded in the United States in order to do that. You can call in with your questions and comments, talk about how Parkinson's disease has intersected in your life, your family's life, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. Let's go to Loretta. And Loretta, hi, you're on the air.
Thank you. I'm curious about how you've spoken a little bit about the difference between essential tremors and Parkinson's, but what test do they do to determine that?
All right, Loretta, thank you for that. And so, Dr. Bao, any kind of testing?
Yeah. So the most important testing to distinguish between Parkinson's and essential tremor is the clinical one. So we don't have a particular blood test in clinic and in practice as if you were to come in today. We don't have a blood test that will say, okay, so, you know, you have one versus the other.
So no biomarkers that would be in my blood that would tell me you have Parkinson's disease?
Correct. But the clinical exam is something that we start from, and it's pretty telling on the most part. Sometimes it gets a little bit more complicated than that, and it might share features from both Parkinson's and essential tremor, at which point we do use to differentiate between the two, we do use what we call the DAT scan, which is a scan of the brain, and it looks at it looks at the dopamine levels in the brain. So it is abnormal in patients who have Parkinson's disease, but it's normal in people who have essential tremor. That would be the best route to go. There's also the skin biopsy looking at a particular protein that is the hallmark of all the Parkinsonian disorders, the alpha-synuclein, and we do a biopsy in the skin and try to detect it. This would not be present in essential tremor.
What about hand wringing? I hear that is also a sign that you may be coming down with Parkinson's.
A hand wringing?
Wringing your hands, like constantly, you know, massaging your hands or wringing your hands. Is that something?
It's a certain movement that you may see in Parkinson's if it has a certain frequency. Most of the typical movements, involuntary movements, are around the 4 to 6 hertz tremor, and it's very characteristic. So again, this is a pattern. It's that we recognize in Parkinson's. So a clinician, a movement disorder specialist, would be able to identify once they see them in the clinic.
And so is there behavioral issues that also come along with Parkinson's disease?
Very interesting question. In terms of behavioral issues, we do see early on that patients may start, even before the diagnosis, may start with increased anxiety or increased depression. Even people who may have not had anxiety or depression in their lives in the history before, they might come up with more anxiety, especially women. Women have more anxiety, women who develop Parkinson's disease. And that continues throughout the disease. So another thing that we do see, and it's not characteristic of the disease, but it's a characteristic of the medication, it's a side effect. It's impulse control disorders, but so certain medications may cause, especially what we call dopamine agonists, may cause more patients to start up gambling or spending or some kind of an excessive part of behavior that is not normal of them. But that we can completely eradicate by just stopping the medication and simply replacing it with something else. So, and of course, later on, we do see much, much later, more advanced Parkinson's, we see mild cognitive decline, then become mild dementia, moderate and severe dementia. And that's probably roughly 20 years after the initial diagnosis is placed, but that is not an exact number. Everyone's different. Everyone with Parkinson has very different timelines. So we can't really put a number to when things are going to happen.
So what do the stages of Parkinson's disease look like?
So we do have a staging system at this point based on the clinical symptoms. The stage one is when the patient has symptoms of tremor and stiffness, stiff muscles and slowness on one side of their body, the arm and leg. That's stage one. And then when it crosses over to the other side of the body, that's stage two. When they become a little unsteady, that's stage three. Stage four is when they really have trouble ambulating. They need a device or a wheelchair to walk and move around. That's stage four. And stage five is when they're bedridden and really, really impacted by the disease.
So what I'm reading here, it says that, you know, Parkinson's isn't really considered like a fatal disease, but what it does is that there's these fatal outcomes because of the falls and, you know, other issues of aspiration, things like that, that come along with it. Is that the way we should be looking at it?
We should be looking at it like any other neurodegenerative disorder, meaning such as Alzheimer's or Lewy body dementia, just to name some of the most known ones. What that is that the disease progresses very slowly. So the patients have difficulties more at the end stage, yes, of walking. So we see multiple fractures when they fall, and that leads to hospitalizations. Usually hospitalizations can lead to more problems, or immobility, or being bedridden they can develop skin sores, open wounds, and yes, their swallowing is also affected. So we see a lot of aspiration pneumonias, which can lead to death. So these are in later stages. We're always checking and making sure that patients are safe in terms of in their environment, their homes. We have them do occupational therapy because we do want to avoid falls. It's very important. We want to make sure that they're not choking on food or liquids. So we do always have frequent swallowing evaluations and swallowing therapy. So things like that, trying to prevent these complications of late stage Parkinson's disease.
So when a person comes in and you just diagnose them as having early stage of Parkinson's, like you're seeing a hand tremor, it's very early on. Do you immediately go to like a medication? When do you decide to start using the deep brain stimulation?
So everyone's different. Everyone has, and even the age of diagnosis is different. So the average age is 65 years of age. But some patients might be 50 years old. They have busy lives, they're working, kids, families. So I do have a conversation with them as to how they want their course to be in terms of therapy. If the symptoms are not bothersome, they can delay oral medication or they can delay therapy. But I certainly ask them to start, if they're not, ask them to start exercise. And we're actually having a clinical trial here at UT where we test patients. We intervene with exercise in very early stage, as exercise has been proven and shown that it may delay the progression of the disease.
Just like walking exercise?
A little bit more than that. So we're talking about increasing your heart rate, yes, up to 80 to 85% of your resting heart rate for a certain period of time. So that is what is beneficial. Walking is better than sitting, but it's not enough. So I would really have a discussion like whether they want to start medication now or wait later. There really is no downside in waiting. or starting. It's all about quality of life. So if someone's working or the tremors bother them socially or at work or in their family, then we probably would go for start medication. Now, a few years down the road, once the patient has started medical therapy, let's say 4 to 5 years later, even three sometimes, we see that the patient has fluctuations of symptoms. The medications are not enough anymore, not because they've gotten used to them or there's some kind of tolerance. That's not really the reason. The reason is because the brain is producing much less dopamine than it used to 4 or 5 years ago when the patient first started medication. So the medication's not enough. And then we can't keep on increasing meds and increasing the doses because there is a limit above which the patient starts having side effects. So then we are kind of limited with our medications. That's when deep brain stimulation comes in to add therapy without the side effects of medications. And because we're supplementing the therapy now with DBS, we can also decrease the medications in a little bit so the patients have less side effects from medications and enjoy more therapy with deep brain stimulation.
All right, we're going to take a break here. We're going to come back. We'll get Juan. He called in. We're going to get him on the air. He wants to know about the side effects of these medications. And if you got a question, call in. We'll answer them. We'll try and get you an answer. 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. Parkinson's disease, it is affecting over a million Americans, more diagnosis cases every year because of our aging population. Let's identify these early symptoms, get people treatment, and help each other. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. We'll be right back. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Dr. Okeanis Bowell is with us, professor of neurology and division chief of the Movement Disorders Program at UT Health San Antonio. She is a leading researcher in addressing Parkinson's disease using deep brain stimulation. We're talking about Parkinson's. We need to have a better awareness of it, break down some of the myths, raise our awareness to try and identify it early, and trying to help people who have it. And the caregivers, there's a lot of burden on them as well. If you've got a question or comment, give us a call, 833-877-8255. Let's go to Juan. Juan, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. I was listening to your program. My wife had Parkinson's. She's since passed away. But your guest was talking about the reactions to some of the medications, the problem is that you get these reactions and you have other medication that you provide to deal with the reactions. So it's not just one set of one particular medication. Sometimes it's two or three. And she mentioned about the side effects, and so I was curious about that because I had heard somewhere along the line that there was a lawsuit against some of those medications or the pharmaceutical who produced those medications, and I was curious about that.
All right, Juan, thank you for the call. So, Dr. Bowell, I guess, so the medication, you're treating the symptoms, right? So what about Juan's question, and what if you don't give the medications? What's life like?
Life is very difficult without the medication, especially depending on the stage, of course, in more advanced stages. So I have some patients who are frustrated by taking medications every 4 or 5 hours, and they just stop, only to resume in a few days later because they see the difference. They can't move when they're off their meds. They can't even, they can't have a life. They're frozen completely. Their tremors are coming back. And it's just people forget what the medications are doing. And by the way, the medication is just a supplementation of what the brain is not producing. It's similar to a diabetic taking insulin because their pancreas is not producing it. So it's exactly the same. We're not giving anything that the brain wouldn't, so to speak, like. So we are, the medications is a dopamine supplementation of the dopamine with what it's not producing. So you're right, but there are side effects such as, like I mentioned earlier, impulse control disorders, nausea, drop of blood pressure, to name a few. And dyskinesias, these kind of dance-like movements that patients might start having. So this is where other therapies, alternate therapies, as we call advanced therapies, now are coming to help with these side effects, such as deep brain stimulation is one, but we're also now seeing that there is a continuous levodopa pump that you don't need surgery to insert it. It goes under the skin. It's what we call subcutaneous. And it provides a very smooth delivery of levodopa to the brain day and night. And the patients don't need to take side effects. So you would ask, but this is a medication still. But yes, we do see that it's better tolerated than taking medications, because medications, one, have a shorter life, and they tend to peak very fast and they're wear off, giving side effects, giving those motor fluctuations that patients experience, and that affects their quality of life. Imagine being at a restaurant and you feel the medication's wearing off, and then all of a sudden you can't, your tremors come out, you can't eat properly, you feel slower and stiffer. That is something that we are trying now, and all the clinical trials and new medications are trying to create a more continuous therapy with less side effects and more benefit. And you're right, it's not just one medication. It's multiple, it's different types. It's DBS, it's pumps, it can be oral medications. So it's a variety, but it really depends on the patient's needs and symptoms. So it's individualized and personalized therapy.
Another caller, let's go to Garvin. Garvin, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Yes, I've been diagnosed with Parkinson's since 2017, July, and it's been progressing slowly. How do I sign up for research, experimental research with UTSA?
Garvin, thank you for your call. So how could he sign up? I mean, are you looking for participants in your studies?
We always are, and thank you for your comments. So if you go to our main page of our movement disorder division and center, you will find a phone number and a link to get involved, and you may or may not meet criteria at a certain time. Like, it really depends on what clinical trials we have. I just want to make sure that that is understood, so we don't have everything for everyone, but we are adding clinical research all the time. So you may not meet the criteria for a certain clinical trial that we have now, but in the next few months, we might bring another one. So once you are in our roster, we can certainly keep you updated.
So the kind of Parkinson's that Michael J. Fox, the actor, he was diagnosed with famously, is that the same kind of Parkinson's that, you know, most people end up getting, or was it different? He got it so young.
That is correct. It is the same kind of Parkinson's. So, like I said, the average age of diagnosis is 65, but that doesn't mean that you cannot get diagnosed at an earlier age, even 30-year-old or 20-year-old. As we move down to earlier diagnoses, earlier ages, we see more mutation as a cause of Parkinson's disease, but it is the same disease. It responds to medications on the most part, it responds the same way. So we're not talking about a different disorder.
And so, what can a person do? You're healthy now, but, you know, you're aging and you want to take care of yourself so that you don't get Parkinson's. Are there lifestyle choices you can make?
Well, if you don't have Parkinson's and you want to invest for the future, as I like to call it, is adopt a healthy life. So we're talking about exercising regularly, four or even more days a week, adopting a very, very healthy diet, such as the Mediterranean diet has proven over and over again to help with aging and with for people who have Parkinson's with progression. It can help with cognition and sleep. Sleep is also extremely important. We know that patients that sleep less than 7 hours have a higher risk of certain neurological disorders, including neurodegeneration and dementia. We also know that if they sleep more than 9 hours, their risk is also increased. So make sure you maintain a good 7 to 8 hour healthy continuous sleep at night. And if you don't have if you have sleep problems or disorders, seek the help of a sleep specialist. I'm also sleep. I have a sleep training in my background. I'm certified sleep medicine. So sleep is extremely important. It's the time that our brain is cleared from all the toxins that we've accumulated by what we metabolize as an organism. And if the brain is not cleared or reset, so to speak, plainly through the night, that with time, we see the impact, and we see that our brain suffers more, and we can lead to neurodegenerative disorders.
Do you think that they could eventually find a cure for Parkinson's?
Well, that's what the whole community is striving towards, and there's a lot of research being done. But I would be happy if we can start with just slowing down the disease. And like I said, what we do know is exercise does slow down the disease, and it's very important. It's better than medication. It's something that we can all do. But no one can really tell or say when the cure will be here. But I think there's been strides done in the last 10 years towards that direction.
When you tell someone, you diagnose them, they come in, they have the hand tremors or they lost the sense of smell, and then you come in and they get tested and you tell them you have Parkinson's. I'm sure you have to be able to provide hope with that. When you tell people, what do you tell them?
That's a very insightful question, and thank you for asking it. So Parkinson's, first of all, is not a death sentence, and it's not what it was perceived. And there's a lot of myths around that. But with the treatment that we have now, the resources, the knowledge that we have, someone diagnosed with Parkinson's can have, if they are being treated in a center where they know about Parkinson's, in a movement disorder center, where it's not just the doctor, but it's the whole team, the physical therapy, occupational therapy, speech therapy, psychologist, social worker, they can have a good quality of life for many, many, many years in the future. So it is not the end. It is a progressive disease. There's ways and there's things that come along almost every year. This is the hope I have. It's not something that I know in the past patients were diagnosed and were like, well, we have Parkinson's, we can't do anything about it. Well, we can do a lot. And we are a community here, and we can do many things, and not just for the patient, but also for the caregiver, because we do recognize the burden of the caregiver and the family that patients with Parkinson's bring to the family. But we are here to help this community, these patients, these families, and there are many things we can do.
Dr. Okeanis Bowell is professor of neurology and division chief of the Movement Disorders Program at UT Health San Antonio. Thank you so much for talking to us today. I really appreciate that. Good luck.
Thank you so much. It was a real pleasure for me.
That's The Source on Texas Public Radio. Thanks for listening.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted by David Martin Davies. Tim Gutierrez is the show's producer. Additional production support from Steve Short, Ruben Garcia, Yvette Benavides, and Dan Katz, Vice President of News. The Source is made possible with support from the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.